The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 30. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. Thank you for joining me on this impromptu live stream. Like always, we've got Sebastian that's checking out the chat. And if you have a question that you want me to for sure see and answer to the best of my ability, make sure you do a super chat and Sebastian will text that right over to me. I'll probably go till about 7:15-ish my time, maybe 7:30. I just got to run to a dinner date and then out to a live music club tonight. So I'm super stoked about that. But a couple topics I wanted to address. First and foremost, I just got hooked up with Rick Rule, and I'm officially an affiliate for their symposium there. Let me actually check out my website right now. That's what I was doing before. Make sure I get it right. I was trying to think of it before. It's the Sprott Natural Resource Symposium in Vancouver, July 21st through 24th. So if you go to my website, georgegammon.com, you'll go under a tab we just set up, which is recommended resources. If you want to sign up there through my affiliate link, that would be amazing. It doesn't cost you anything extra. And one thing that you will notice if you go to the website and check out that page is one guy we added to the list with Grant Williams, Jim Rickards, Rick Rule, Doug Casey, Ross Beattie, is a guy by the name of George Gammon. That is right. I will be there. Now, I'm not speaking, nothing fancy like that, but I will definitely be there. So if you guys have a chance to go up there, make sure you do it through my affiliate link. And when we're there, make sure you say hi, grab a beer, do something like that. Or maybe I can answer some questions. Or maybe you can answer some of my questions. Okay, so let's get right into the chat. Nothing from Sebastian. So if you guys have a question, make sure you put question first in capital letters. So you've got Dennis here talking about Lynette. Your interview with Lynette was among the best she has ever done and great tribute to your matching intellect and skill. Lynette's really cool. I hadn't talked to her before then. Really enjoyed her insight. I didn't know how long she had been in the business. That was really impressive. If you haven't seen that, check that out. That interview, and she was actually a stockbroker during Black Monday in 1987. So it was really super cool to get her insider's view on that. Question from EOX. Many political commentators believe Trump will win the election in November. If this is true and he does win, would it then be safe to YOLO? Why is everyone using YOLO? I don't know. On every single chat stream. And YOLO on some tin. What is this? Sebastian, look at this. It's another one of these YOLO tendy things. I don't know what that is. I don't know what you're asking me. Just speak English. Let me know what you're saying. I know YOLO is you only live once, but I don't know what this other thing is. So just try to reword the question in just plain English. Okay, Tony, thank you for the super chat. All in on gold and silver. Okay. I know your thoughts on that. It's Lynette's fault, but happy about my jump later. Yeah, congratulations on the jump lately. I would suggest a different strategy, but hey, it's working for you, so that's great. You've got, I don't know what your allocation is, 50-50, but you've got half insurance, half speculation. It doesn't pay you to own it, but if that's what makes you feel comfortable and that's what you feel is best, by all means, all I can do. I'm not saying my way is right or wrong. It's just what I do for myself and what I suggest for my friends and family. And if you guys want to take bits and pieces of that strategy and allocate it to your own system, that's fantastic. So, but congratulations on the jump. That's awesome. Gianni, thank you for the super chat. Shout out from Ontario, Canada. Great. Oh, if you're in Canada, you should shoot over to Rick Rule's deal in the end of July, just right over there in Vancouver. Great show. Been following you for several months now. Thank you, sir, for the content. Question on the next message. Okay. don't know if we got the next message yet. Sebastian, I'm sure, is getting that to me. So in the interim, question, blue skies. Why are all CNBC commentators always so bullish? What am I missing? That's a great question. It's got to get them ratings. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think there's, especially when you're dealing with the media, I mean, they've got their preconceived bias. A lot of them, maybe that's it. Maybe a lot of them are in the market themselves. And just for their own personal reasons, they want the market to go up because they're heavily invested. So maybe they like to rationalize, makes them feel better. But I don't know. I know I don't agree with it. And there are a few people every once in a while that present the other side of the coin. But I would just say ratings. Ratings are some sort of personal bias because they themselves are invested. Okay, here is Johnny's question. Looking into making an investment in a rental property, I can get a 5-bed townhome under 700. Is now really a good time? Economic climate. Should I wait, get more with my dollar, or because it's a cash flow investment, it won't matter? Well, it's not that it won't matter, but you've got to look at the cash flow first and foremost. I don't know what you're getting in rent though, Gianni. Just because something costs $700,000 and is a 5-bedroom, not sure that would qualify as a good investment. We've got to make sure that we're trying to get close to a 1% RV ratio. So on that, you'd need to get $7,000 a month gross rent to have that in the sweet spot. So I would have to know the cash flow to give you any good advice, buddy. Okay, Trey asks, thank you very much, by the way, Trey, for the super chat. How do you intend to protect yourself when the housing bubble pops? I mean, your underlying asset will be cut in half. How do you recover from that? But Trey, what are you buying? Really? Or remember, you're buying the cash flow and you're buying fixed rate debt in the mortgage. So let's just say right now with my rental properties in Kansas City, I'm getting $1,400 a month in rent. My cost basis on those, about $75,000. Granted, that was back in 2012. But even if you bought them now, let's say you're out of pocket $140,000. Right? You're getting that $1,400 a month in rent. That's paying down your mortgage, your building principal. There's probably inflation. So you're paying it back with cheaper dollars. You're getting paid to short the dollar. And then let's say we have a market correction, a crash, where your $140,000 asset goes down to $100,000. Or let's say that it doubles in price and it goes to $280,000. Okay. It doesn't change anything because you don't have to sell and you don't want to sell because you're holding it just indefinitely. So if it goes up or down in price, it doesn't matter unless it's affecting the cash flow. Then it matters. Then it definitely 100% matters. But you've really got to stop. And when I say you, I'm just talking about everyone in general. And I see this so often. People, they start with the question of, is this asset that I'm going to purchase going to go up or down in price? No, that's not the first question to ask. You might not even want to ask that question. It's, is this cheap or is it expensive? In the case of real estate, it's not cheap, but you're not buying the real estate. You're just buying a way to play cash flow and fixed rate long-term debt. That's the key. And then, so how do I hedge further? Then you want to make sure that the asset that you are, or the real estate that you are buying to leverage that debt and cash flow, you want to make sure that has as little downside as possible. So that's why I like to go into linear markets that don't go up or down that much. And hopefully the price to income ratio isn't all out of whack. So that's why I stick with Kansas City and I don't go to LA. I don't go into any of these markets where you've got much more downside if and when we do have a crash. And I totally agree, the housing market is in a bubble, but you've got to compartmentalize the way that you look at those things. Vara, thank you for the super chat. Are you worried you are too late to the party on the miners? How do you feel about potential oil play Eric Townsend is talking about? Love your videos. I don't know the exact play that Eric is talking about, but my guess is I'd probably like it because Eric is one smart dude and he knows oil as well as anybody a heck of a lot better than I do. So I would probably like it. That doesn't mean that I would do it, but I would know that it's backed up by a lot of research and data and not a lot of emotion, which is good. As far as the minors, I'm not sure that you're late to the party. What I would start with, because I look at that as a speculation, is where's the price of gold? Is it historically cheap? You look at how much it costs them to produce and look at so let's say that it costs them $1,200 to get it out of the ground. They're selling it for $1,600. So you get that $400 spread or whatever percentage that is. I would go back and see throughout time, has that meant it's cheap or expensive? And I would start there. And then assuming that it was cheap and you thought it had some more upside, then I would look at the miners. And then I would assume that if I'm bullish on gold, I'm going to be bullish on the miners. Now, I might favor the silver miners for a speculation because that ratio is a little more out of whack as far as the gold to silver ratio. So they might be a little more cheap. And going back to the conversation that I had with Rick Rule, if you guys saw that, you know that there are a lot fewer good silver miners than there are gold. Therefore, if you find a good one and silver does go up, like gold most likely will in the future, you know, 5 years, 10 years, then those silver miners will go up more than the gold miners. So it's so the gold miners are a leverage way to play gold, and the silver miners are even a more leveraged way to play the gold miner, or the silver miners are even a more leveraged way to play the gold miners. So I think that's probably my best advice. I don't know that you're late to the party, but that's how I'd look at it. Oh yeah, JB is talking about Zillow lost $6,500 a house they flipped. I think it was more than that, JB. I thought it was like 60 grand. It was some. I thought it was even more than that. Maybe I didn't read the headline right. But yeah, that was a disaster waiting to happen. Okay, Thomas, question. 1% RV, sweet spot. But many Hartman properties are less than that, but still cash flow, according to the pro formas. Is there a base cash flow to shoot for? Well, you got to be positive cash flow, that's for sure. What other ways are there to do? Well, your price to income is another one. Oh, yeah, due diligence. Right. Just as you wrote that, that popped in my head, Thomas. Price to income, they have to be cash flow positive. They just have to. It's not a 1%. Try to do as well as you can. It's just getting so tough, guys, because this everything bubble is just squeezing the heck out of everybody, making everyone go further out the risk curve for less of a yield and return. Man, I wish I had a silver bullet for everyone. I mean, the simple or the best thing to do is make sure you get a couple solid rental properties and then diversify and maybe look outside the United States, but I know that's not for everybody. But you just got to try to find stuff that's cheap, and it's just getting almost impossible. And I wish I had a better answer, but that's just the truth. Okay, Jacob, thank you for the chat. Oh, I'm sorry, Smash Brothers Brawl says, hello, George. I have a question. What effects does the Fed buying up more than $1 trillion in mortgage-backed securities post 08 have on the mortgage markets, generally speaking? Well, it's going to lower the interest rates. Meaning it's going to push the prices up. So whomever is selling those MBSs, most likely Fannie Freddie packaging those. So Fannie Freddie goes to the retail banks. They buy them before the ink's dry. They bundle them up and then they sell them to Wall Street. So if there's artificial demand for those, that means the prices are going to be artificially high. Rates are going to be artificially low. And so that's the first knock-on effect, is that the institutions like Fannie and Freddie, although I don't know the specific plumbing there, I would assume that they're making a lot more profit than they otherwise would, or whomever is packaging those mortgages into mortgage-backed securities and then flipping them into the financial economy, they're making more profit than they otherwise would. I mean, it's just such a hall of mirrors. There's no price discovery. This is a perfect example that you bring up. What is the price of these mortgage-backed securities? We don't know. We have no idea, because the Fed has been manipulating the market so substantially that we don't know if the interest rate, the market interest rate on that mortgage-backed security should be 3% or 8%. That's why there's so much risk in the system right now. Okay, Jacob, thank you for the super chat. It says, thank you for everything you do. You are very welcome, Jacob. I really enjoy this stuff. So I'm sure you guys can probably figure that out. 19 years old. Whoa, 19 years old. Fantastic, Jacob. Good for you, buddy. 19 years old, getting into this stuff. That is really awesome. At your age, I was a complete loser. Although a lot of people would argue that I'm still a complete loser. And every so often, I might agree with them. Okay, 19 years old and looking to get into long-term setup. Well, okay, got into real estate once, got out of the military. Awesome. What's your three top tips for success? You're the best. Number one, number two, and number three are all the same, Jacob, for someone your age. House hack. There is nothing you can do that can set you up for the future better than to buy a triplex. Again, it's got to be cash flow positive. And I understand we're in a housing bubble. I completely agree with you. We're in a housing bubble. But Jacob should not buy that thing just to hope the price goes up. He should buy it so he doesn't have to come out of pocket for his living expenses. Doesn't have a mortgage, doesn't have a rent payment. He's subbing that out to his tenants. Therefore, he can take that money that he would have spent on housing, which is 90% of Americans. That's their number one expense. And he can take that money and he can invest it. Maybe not now, but maybe he can just accumulate dry powder. When the market goes down, it crashes, whether it's the stock market, he can get some fantastic dividend paying stocks. Maybe it's the housing market. He can go and get some good cash flow, some good cash flowing properties at more than a 1% RV ratio. And it's just, there's no downside to that. And then in 30 years, whatever it is, it's paid off, Jacob, you own it. Now the whole thing is positive cash flow, and you've got an asset there that you can hold the rest of your life. You can leverage against it. You can invest more. You can take that equity out. And it's just, even if you just sit on it, and let's say you're 50 years old, you're going to have $3,000 or $4,000 coming in a month. That's your retirement right there. And then you can subsidize that with whatever else you're able to earn. It's just a total no-brainer. So I can't suggest that enough, Jacob. House hack. Jose, thank you for the super chat. My question will be, what kind of investment you will do in Puerto Rico? Well, I'm not sure that I would invest in Puerto Rico other than moving there. That would be my investment. Because if you got a type of business that's mobile, or if you're in the financial, well, I'm not going to say that. I was going to say the financial business, but not all of them. There's some businesses that if you move that business to Puerto Rico, it drops your tax rate down to zero or a maximum of 4%. Can't beat it. It's the only place in the entire world where a U.S. citizen does not have to pay U.S. tax. Only place in the world. And it's just, if you're making, call it $200,000-$400,000 a year. And I think that the bar for applying for that or qualifying has been even lowered. So even you're making $100,000-$150,000, if you're in the right type of business, it could really make sense to move there. So that's the way I would first and foremost look at investing in Puerto Rico. Outside of that, it's going to be tough to get any type of good RV ratio. Yeah. other than just setting up a business there, I think that's the best way you can invest in Puerto Rico and moving yourself there, getting residency. Carlos, thank you for the super chat. Whiteboard video on XRP, global currency, Ripple, and rumor on the future Mar-a-Lago Accord. Yeah, I've actually seen that on Twitter, and I need to do some homework on that. That could be a good topic for next week. I'll check that out. As far as Ripple, Carlos, I just hate to do a video just to do a video. And I really like sticking to videos that I feel are going to add a tremendous amount of value for the individual who that video is targeted to. So if I don't want to do just a video on quantitative easing that every single other person out there is doing and that you guys have seen a million times, if I have some sort of specific angle or insight through my research that no one else has, then I want to do a video on quantitative easing or just fill in the blank. Every once in a while, I'll do something that's topical, whether it's the Cerveza sickness or the repo market. But see, the great thing with macro is that even if something is just topical, it's such a fun three-dimensional puzzle that there's always something that you can find that's outside of what most people are talking about. And it's something they should be paying attention to, but maybe they aren't paying attention to because it would require them to do 4 hours of reading and really get down into the weeds to figure out how this thing works. You've got to understand that that's what I get off on. I love that. I love figuring out how things work. So my point is that that's what I like to do videos about. And I just don't feel as though I'm good enough with Ripple to add any value or any insight above and beyond what you probably already know. So, and that's not to say that I'm proud of that. I definitely want to learn more about Bitcoin, more about Ripple, more about all cryptocurrencies. But I'm going to put forth the effort in the months to come, but until that time, I probably won't do a video on it. But I'll do a lot of interviews to get the advice of professionals when I'm on that journey. So hopefully that makes sense and you can understand why I'm kind of shying away from doing videos like that. Okay, so Sebastian, I'm looking at the time, 7:05. I know we've got a lot of super chats in the pipeline. Let's go ahead and just, you guys, let's no more super chats because I'm going to have to get out of here about 7:15 or 7:30 to make my dinner appointment. And I want to make sure that I answer all the super chats. Don't want to leave anybody hanging. Stay curious. Thank you for the super chat. Are the banks going to lose a lot of money by holding on to these pre-foreclosures? It seems we're at the peak of housing here in LA. I'm guessing you're talking about Keith Giroux's research, the real estate expert with MarketWatch. Assuming that you're talking about that, you've watched some of my videos on that. What's happening is, just for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, what Keith's angle is that a lot of the banks haven't foreclosed on people, even though they're not paying their mortgages, because they're waiting for the prices to go up beyond a level, a price point, where they're able to sell and recoup 100% of what they lent them. You say, well, George, that's crazy, because if they lent out $100,000, the home is now $125,000. Why don't they go ahead and foreclose and then sell it and recoup their cost? Well, because it cost them a lot more. When you add in all the legal fees, all the upkeep, getting it up to that property, up to a point where they can sell it again, let's say it costs them $30,000. Well, they still have to wait, even though it's appreciated nominally more than what they have out of pocket in the loan itself. So there's a lot of moving parts there. You've got to compartmentalize the banks. You can't just lump them all into one bucket. It depends if the banks kept those loans on their books or not. And Giroux breaks this down quite well. If you've got a typical bank like Wells Fargo, no, it's not going to affect them because they sold that paper 10 years ago before the ink was dry, like I said earlier. As soon as you sign on the dotted line right there, George Gammon, they're like, okay, great. Yeah, bye, Mr. Gammon. Here, Fannie Freddie, there you go. Give us our money. They don't keep those loans on their books. But some banks do. So the banks that keep those on their books, they are obviously at risk. The banks that don't, probably not so much. And I'm thinking through, I don't want to say not so much, because those other banks, how would that, there'd be a systemic risk there that I don't want to downplay. Even if those banks are unloading that paper to Fannie and Freddie, see, I'm trying to think this through right here in real time, guys. If they sold that paper to Fannie and Freddie, see, that would deplete see, if things go down, you know where it could, if you guys really want to go down a rabbit hole, and this is how I do the whiteboard videos, just FYI. Okay, so they're taking those mortgages. They're selling them to Fannie Freddie. Fannie and Freddie bundles them, sells them to Wall Street. Wall Street sells them to, who knows, other banks, private individuals, hedge funds. But then let's think about this. Then those mortgage-backed securities are potentially lent into the dollar funding markets, like the repo market. So that collateral is providing liquidity for the banks, not just the banks that are keeping those loans on their books, but also the banks that are selling them as fast as they can do them. So if the housing market tanked, that would mean less mortgages, and it would mean the mortgages that they are writing are going to be for a lower dollar amount. If they're doing fewer mortgages and the dollar amount of those mortgages goes down, that means less collateral for the dollar funding markets. Less collateral means less potential liquidity, which drives up the risk for all banks, not just the banks that are keeping them meaning those loans, on their portfolio. I knew I was missing something there. I answered that question too quickly. So hopefully that made sense. That's probably a good whiteboard video. But let me go back to your question to make sure I'm answering it thoroughly. Are the banks going to lose a lot of money by holding these foreclosures? Okay, so my specific answer would be the banks that are holding those loans on their books, yes, there's a direct correlation to them losing money if we have a housing crash. Indirectly, that would affect all the other banks in a variety of ways. But the first way that popped into my mind was less collateral for dollar funding, which, to Jeff Snyder's point, is a really big issue right now. Traveling Ronan, thank you for the super chat. An Aussie. I'm going to dinner with an Aussie right now, Ronan, just FYI. An Aussie here, and a lot of Aussies in Medellin, believe it or not. As an Aussie, I fear a future fall in USD will be greater than the rise in the gold price, putting me in negative position in AUD terms. Okay, so you're afraid the fall in the USD will be greater. Okay, so if gold goes up in USD in real terms, then yeah, but see, it all depends on the cross rate of USD and the Aussie dollar. Just because the USD goes down in relationship to gold doesn't mean that it's also going down against the Aussie dollar. It could, but currencies are completely detached, and they're a cross rate between one another. So you could have the Aussie Central Bank print so much money that the Aussie dollar could go down, even though gold was going up against the dollar in real terms. So do you think I should take a currency hedge? I'd have to know how you're hedging out that currency risk. I don't know if I'd worry about it too much. As long as you've got 10% of your portfolio in gold, I don't know that I would really worry about what denomination my expenses were, whether I pay my bills in dollars, Aussie dollars, Singapore dollars, Colombian pesos. Not sure I'd worry about it too much, as long as I've got a good portion of my portfolio in physical gold. Hopefully that answers your question, John. Okay, Crypto Angels, thank you for the super chat. A little Bitcoin wouldn't hurt. I totally agree. Totally agree. That I've got Alex coming up again, and I'm going to be reaching out to some more Bitcoin experts based on your guys' advice or who you'd like to see. And so I'm going to do that prior to doing whiteboard videos on them so I can get my competency level high enough to where I feel I can add value by actually doing a whiteboard video. As I said earlier. Okay, Toro, thank you for the super chat. How successful would you have been if married and kids? I think, well, how do you define success, right? I mean, I think there's, I mean, the pros would definitely outweigh the cons if you've got kids. I mean, kids, how can you argue that, right? I mean, kids are that kids are the best, right? So being married, I think that it depends if you find the right person, obviously. Boy, that's a good one. I'm struggling with this one, guys. Sorry. I just want to give you guys a really as accurate an answer as I can. I think, and I'm assuming you're talking about financially, Toro. I think I would have been financially successful because being financially successful has everything to do with your ability to manage people, to solve problems, and to be able to do things that very few people can do. My buddy, when we were in college, my best buddy, he said it so well. He said, I think that the amount of money that you can make is directly correlated to how many people can do what you do. And the fewer people that can do what you do, most likely, the more money you're going to make. So I think I would have been financially successful regardless, but probably in a different way. I think that's the answer I'm looking for. I think I would have been financially successful, maybe more, maybe less, but it would not have been in the same way because the way that I became financially successful was by flying all over the world and setting up businesses in all these crazy locations and just going wherever the money's going to take me. And that probably wouldn't have been realistic, or maybe would have been realistic with a family, but that sure as heck wouldn't have been fair to the wife and kids, that's for sure. And that's one of the main reasons that I didn't go that direction. That's a whole other story. I don't want to go down that path. But yeah, I think that's the best way I can answer it. I wouldn't be worried about, oh, shoot, if I get married and have kids, I'm not going to be successful. I think if you've got the skill set and people can develop that skill set, that you're going to make it happen. It's just you might make it happen in a different way. That's a great question, Matt. As you guys can tell, it's a lot easier for me to answer questions on the repo market than it is about my personal life. All right. Funding Jim, thank you for the super chat. $13,000 a month positive cash flow. Fantastic. 600,000 owned. Oh, 600,000 owed and 2 million. Okay, so I'm not understanding this completely. You've got 13 grand a month positive cash flow. Got it. Awesome. You owe 600 grand on a mortgage, I'm assuming, on $2 million in California real estate. And you're getting $13,000 a month positive cash flow? All right. I think you must have bought at a very good time, my friend. That is, I don't have my phone with me. So 13 grand. Yeah, that's a rock solid. And well, off of two. Yeah, that's still pretty solid. So I'm not sure what your question is. But see, 13, so you're at 130, you're around 150, 160, you got two, that's 16, so about an 8% net return. That's pretty solid. Yeah, that's really solid. I'd stick with that for sure, if that's your question. Or maybe you're just bragging. I don't know. If you're bragging, I'll give you a virtual high five, my friend. Alexander, thank you for the super chat. Do you think the Fed feels pressure from the federal government other than the Treasury to keep the bubble pumped so they don't face negative legislation? I think they feel a hell of a lot more pressure now than they did in the past, because I agree with Dr. Barton Wang, who was on Real Vision. I highlighted that clip on a past video. But he was talking about the TGA, which is the Treasury General Account. And if you look at a chart of the TGA now, or going back over the past 8 years compared to before the GFC, the difference is shocking. And he feels as though the powers that be in the government, maybe in the administration, could, if they wanted to, utilize that as like a weapon, and not to seem like they're going to destroy the economy with it. But what he means is, because they've allowed that war chest to go so high, last time I checked, it was at $400 billion. And I think Mnuchin was talking about potentially taking it up to $600 billion. Well, if that's the case, then they could basically do QE. They could do more than QE. So let's say they wait 3 months before the election and then all of a sudden start pumping $200 billion into the system. That's basically QE right there, to a certain degree. So that would most likely have the effect of lifting markets. And or the opposite of that, they can take money out of the system by allowing that balance sheet to continue to go up. And therefore, that forces the Fed to be a bigger part of the financial system. In other words, print more money and keep interest rates low, which obviously is exactly what Trump wants, at least if we take him by what he says in his tweets and in the media. So it puts the Treasury in this really interesting kind of power position with the Fed. I'm pretty sure the Fed is cognizant of that. And my guess is that they probably don't like it a lot. And so I would say, yes, I think they do feel pressure from that standpoint. Is if they feel direct political pressure, like Trump calling them up and saying, hey, you guys, you better do this. Or through a tweet saying, hey, pal, you're a jackass, which is basically what he says. I don't know that they feel too much pressure there, because I think they're kind of above that name calling. But who knows? Who knows? And negative legislation. I don't know that there's negative legislation that could directly affect the Fed. Maybe you're talking about negative legislation for the economy, then the Fed would have to step in indirectly if per their mandates, which are ridiculous. Okay, Tony, thank you for the super chat. And John, we got to do the last one, Jonathan. We got to do that, because I got to get out of here. Okay, Tony asks, how about a roundtable with you, Rickards, Zhang, Schiff, Ron Paul, and that crazy Dent guy? Oh, well, I would love it. I mean, that would be fantastic, especially Ron Paul. I mean, what an honor it would be to meet Ron Paul. I mean, all those people, would be an honor to meet him, but man, Ron Paul is just in a league of his own, in my opinion. And I'd love to meet Harry Dent as well. So yeah, let's set it up, Tony. I'd love to make it happen. Or at least maybe like one of those Zoom chats with all four or five of us. I don't know. They probably wouldn't be into it, but boy, I sure would. I sure would be. Wu Ollie, thank you for the super chat. What do you think on the yield curve re-inverting and the 30-year Treasury bond hitting a historic low today? Well, I trust the bond market a hell of a lot more than I trust the stock market. That's for sure. But there are so many moving parts there, buddy. I mean, this would take me an hour to answer this question, because you not only have the Cerveza sickness, flight to safety, pushing down bond yields, but then you've got the need for all these banks to have those bonds just to do business. You've got so much demand for those bonds from a standpoint of collateral, like I was saying earlier, in these dollar funding markets, and they have to have them to meet these regulations like Basel III or the coverage ratio, the LCR. So if I had to give you my opinion on the yield curve inverting, also, too, if you look historically, when we really get into trouble, it's not when the yield curve inverts initially. It's when it inverts, steepens, and then inverts. And as you guys all know, what was it, 6-8 months ago, it inverted, then it steepened, now it's inverting again. But there's so many artificial non-market factors that go into it, the Hall of Mirrors. I'm not sure that I would put as much weight into it as far as a recession indicator as I typically would, but I wouldn't bury my head in the sand. And I think it's just another indicator that the world economy has some big, big problems, regardless of what you see in the stock market. Hey, Tommy, what's up, buddy? Hope you're having an awesome Friday evening, driving around in that Corvette. Cha-ching. Did we convert you into a gold bug in time? Next video, plunge protection team. Yeah, we got to get my buddy Jason on for that. I think that's his term. No, listen, I've always been in, I don't know if I consider myself a gold bug. I just think it's prudent to own. So I don't think I'd say that I've been converted. As far as doing a video on the plunge protection team, maybe, but I'd have to know something through my research that I feel as though it would add value and isn't just the same old thing you've always heard. Or maybe I could explain it in a way that maybe other people haven't been able to explain, just with the whiteboard and the editors. So I'll definitely look into it, but I'm not sure that's on the list for next week. I've got some good ones on the list, by the way. Jonathan, thank you for the super chat. You've mentioned counterparty risk associated with the GLD. Since the custodian, I didn't know that. The custodian of IAU is JP Morgan. Is that a safer choice? Why do you want to own the GLD? Maybe you have to own it for your 401k or your, I don't know why you have to own the paper. Why not just own the physical? I don't know. I just rather have the physical stuff. I don't like the paper unless you're speculating, or maybe you're just trading it like intraday. Then you might want to, then I think the GLD makes sense. Luke Groman and I actually had that discussion. But I mean, if you're just trading it, then I really wouldn't worry about the counterparty risk in the GLD. But if you're holding it as insurance, like paper gold, then I would just hold physical. Okay, we got to stop the super chats, guys, because I got to run. Neurosurgery, thank you very much. If the dollar increases in value and interest rates increase, then you should be in cash. What happens in that case to the value income properties and their respective cash flow? Well, you have to think of the probabilities of what would have to happen for that to occur. So let's think that through. Dollar increases, and let's define how the dollar is increasing. So is the dollar increasing against foreign currencies? Because like Brent Johnson pointed out very well, the dollar can go up in the FX markets, but can also lose purchasing power. So we can have inflation in the United States. We could have 10% inflation, and the dollar could go up against the yen or the Colombian peso or the euro. So you could see the DXY going to 110 and consumer prices in the United States going up relative to the dollar. All these things can be separate moving parts in and of themselves, right? And you got to look at this as this puzzle, and this piece is spinning over here and this piece is spinning over there. And sometimes it's correlated, sometimes it's not. But for the dollar to increase, meaning domestically, so that would mean deflation. And I'm assuming you'd mean asset price deflation, because to get consumer price deflation, that would be difficult. But to get deflation as far as asset prices, that could happen. We get interest rates going up. Therefore, the value of the income properties would most likely go down. But that doesn't mean that the cash flow would go down. Because if people are having a harder time purchasing homes, that means there's going to be a larger renting pool by definition. In my opinion, in the short term, over the next, if that happens, over the 2 year, 3 year time horizon, that actually bumps rents. If that were to go on for, call it 10 years, then I think people would transition into different ways of living because they just had no other choice. So in other words, more people living in a house or in the same square footage. So they change their habits, their behavioral habits or patterns altogether. And then you would see downward pressure on cash flow, but that would take quite a while. So the dollar increasing, that can happen, but I think the probabilities of that are pretty darn low. But it's great to think through that and to analyze what you think the probabilities are. I mean, forget what I'm saying. I'm just trying to think it through for you. And then if you think the probabilities are different, then you can adjust your portfolio accordingly. Hey, Robbie, thank you for the super chat. Real estate in US isn't cheap right now. You're darn straight it's not. It is not cheap at all. And I hate that, but it is possible to find cheap cash flow. And we all know the debt is super, super cheap. Silver is. You are right on the money, my friend, but silver doesn't pay you to own it. So therefore, I'm not saying don't own it. I'm just saying don't consider it an investment. Just realize that it's a speculation and therefore it should be a different percentage of your portfolio if you want to do things like I do. And that doesn't mean that it's the right way to do it. Okay, Troll McTrollerson, great name. Okay, I don't know if that's going to get me in trouble. I don't want to. Yeah, I'll save that one for the chat, but I appreciate the super chat, buddy. All right, guys, we're going to wrap things up here. Remember, if you are interested in going to Rick Rules, I'm going to go to my website so I get the name right, the Sprott Natural Resource Symposium in Vancouver, July 21st and through the 24th. I will be there. So if you want to go up there and say hi to me and enjoy an awesome weekend of getting to meet guys like Rick Rule and James Rickards and Doug Casey. Oh, who else? Oh, and Grant Williams. Man, that's going to be awesome. I cannot wait to hear Grant Williams speak live. That I'm really looking forward to. So if you guys want or are considering that, do me a favor, do the channel a favor, and go through our affiliate link. It doesn't cost you a thing, and it definitely helps us out a bunch. Check out the podcast and check out the live stream Sunday night at its normal time, 7 p.m. And I'm going to have a special guest to talk to you more about macro real estate and all the stuff that we love. So guys, enjoy your Friday night. Have an awesome weekend. And I will see you Sunday evening.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.